This is a 2008 reading of the book by Rudolf Steiner, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment. This is Chapter 6, Some Results of Initiation. One of the fundamental principles of true spiritual science is that the one who devotes himself to its study should do so with full consciousness. He should attempt nothing and practice nothing without knowledge of the effect produced. A teacher of spiritual science who gives advice or instruction will at the same time always explain to those striving for higher knowledge the effects produced on body, soul, and spirit, if his advice and instructions be followed. Some effects produced upon the soul of the student will here be indicated. For only those who know such things as they are here communicated can undertake in full consciousness the exercises that lead to knowledge of the higher worlds. Without the latter, no genuine esoteric training is possible. For it must be understood that all groping in the dark is discouraged, and that failure to pursue this training with open eyes may lead to mediumship, but not to the exact clairvoyance in the sense of spiritual science. The exercises described in the preceding chapters, if practiced in the right way, involve certain changes in the organism of the soul, astral body. The latter is only perceptible to the clairvoyant, and may be compared to a cloud, psycho-spiritually luminous to a certain degree, in the center of which the physical body is discernible. Parenthesis, a description will be found in the author's book titled Theosophy. Close parenthesis. In this astral body, desires, lusts, passions, and ideas become visible in a spiritual way. Sensual appetites, for instance, create the impression of a dark red radiance with a definite shape. A pure and noble thought finds its expression in a reddish-violet radiance. The clear-cut concept of the logical thinker is experienced as a yellowish figure with sharply defined outline. The confused thought of the muddled head appears as a figure with a vague outline. The thoughts of a person with one-sided queer views appear sharply outlined but immobile, while the thoughts of people accessible to the points of view of others are seen to be mobile, changeable outlines. In all these and the following descriptions, it must be noted that by seeing a color, spiritual seeing is meant. When the clairvoyant speaks of seeing red, he means, I have an experience in a psycho-spiritual way, which is equivalent to the physical experience when an impression of red is received. This mode of expression is here used because it is perfectly natural to the clairvoyant. If this point is overlooked, a mere color vision may easily be mistaken for a genuine clairvoyant experience. The further the student advances in his inner development, the more regular will be the differentiation within his astral body. The latter is confused and undifferentiated in the case of a person of undeveloped inner life. Yet the clairvoyant can perceive even the unorganized astral body as a figure standing out distinctly from its environment. It extends from the center of the head to the middle of the physical body and appears like an independent body possessing certain organs. The organs now to be considered are perceptible to the clairvoyant near the following parts of the physical body. The first, between the eyes. The second, near the larynx. The third, in the region of the heart. The fourth, in the so-called pit of the stomach. The fifth and sixth are situated in the abdomen. These organs are technically known as wheels, chakrams, or lotus flowers. They are so-called on account of their likeness to wheels or flowers. But, of course, it should be clearly understood that such an expression is not to be applied more literally than is the term wings when referring to the two halves of the lungs. Just as there is no question of wings in the case of the lungs, so too, in the case of the lotus flowers, the expression must be taken figuratively. In undeveloped persons, these lotus flowers are dark in color, motionless, and inert. In the clairvoyant, however, they are luminous, mobile, and of variegated color. Something of this kind applies to the medium, though in a different way. This question, however, need not be pursued here any further. Now, when the student begins his exercises, the lotus flowers become more luminous. Later on, they begin to revolve. When this occurs, clairvoyance begins. For these flowers are the sense organs of the soul, and their revolutions express the fact that the clairvoyant perceives supersensibly. What was said previously concerning spiritual seeing applies equally to these revolutions and even to the lotus flowers themselves. No one can perceive the supersensible until he has developed his astral senses in this way. Thanks to the spiritual organ situated in the vicinity of the larynx, it becomes possible to survey clairvoyantly the thoughts and mentality of other beings, and to obtain a deeper insight into the true laws of natural phenomena. The organ situated near the heart permits of clairvoyant knowledge of the sentiments and disposition of other souls. When developed, this organ also makes it possible to observe certain deeper forces in animals and plants. By means of the organ in the so-called pit of the stomach, knowledge is acquired of the talents and capacities of souls. By its means, too, the part played by animals, plants, stones, metals, atmospheric phenomena, and so on, in the household of nature, becomes apparent. The organ in the vicinity of the larynx has 16 petals, or spokes, the one in the region of the heart, 12, and the one in the pit of the stomach, 10. Now, certain activities of the soul are connected with the development of these organs, and anyone devoting himself to them in a certain definite way contributes something to the development of the corresponding organs. In the 16-petal lotus, 8 of its 16 petals were developed in the remote past, during an earlier stage of human evolution. Man himself contributed nothing to this development. He received them as a gift from nature, at a time when his consciousness was in a dull, dreamy condition. At that stage of human evolution, they were in active use. But the manner of their activity was only compatible with that dull state of consciousness. As consciousness became clearer and brighter, the petals became obscured and ceased their activity. Man himself can now develop the remaining 8 petals by means of conscious exercises, and thereby the whole lotus flower becomes luminous and mobile. The acquisition of certain faculties depends on the development of each one of the 16 petals. Yet, as already shown, only 8 can be consciously developed. The remainder then appear of their own accord. The development proceeds in the following manner. The student must first apply himself with care and attention to certain functions of the soul hitherto exercised by him in a careless and inattentive manner. There are 8 such functions. The first is the way in which ideas and conceptions are acquired. In this respect, people usually allow themselves to be led by chance alone. They see or hear one thing or another, and form their ideas accordingly. As long as this is the case, the 16 petals of the lotus flower remain ineffective. It is only when the student begins to take his self-education in hand in this respect that the petals become effective. His ideas and conceptions must be guarded. Each single idea should acquire significance for him. He should see in it a definite message instructing him concerning the things of the outer world, and he should derive no satisfaction from ideas devoid of such significance. He must govern his mental life so that it becomes a true mirror of the outer world, and direct his effort to the exclusion of incorrect ideas from his soul. The second of these functions is concerned with the control of resolutions. The student must not resolve upon even the most trifling act without well-founded and thorough consideration. Thoughtless and meaningless actions should be foreign to his nature. He should have well-considered grounds for everything he does, and abstain from everything to which no significant motive urges him. The third function concerns speech. The student should utter no word that is devoid of sense and meaning. All talking for the sake of talking draws him away from his path. He must avoid the usual kind of conversation with its promiscuous discussion of indiscriminately varied topics. This does not imply his preclusion from intercourse with his fellows. It is precisely in such intercourse that his conversation should develop to significance. He is ready to converse with everyone, but he does so thoughtfully and with thorough deliberation. He never speaks without grounds for what he says. He seeks to use neither too many nor too few words. The fourth is the regulation of outward action. The student tries to adjust his actions in such a way that they harmonize with the actions of his fellow men and with the events in his environment. He refrains from actions which are disturbing to others and in conflict with his surroundings. He seeks to adjust his actions so that they combine harmoniously with his surroundings and with his position in life. When an external motive causes him to act, he considers how he can best respond. When the impulse proceeds from himself, he weighs with minute care the effects of his activity. The fifth function includes the management of the whole of life. The student endeavors to live in conformity with both nature and spirit. Never over hasty, he is also never indolent. Excessive activity and laziness are equally alien to him. He looks upon life as a means for work and disposes it accordingly. He regulates his habits and the care of his health in such a way that an harmonious whole is the outcome. The sixth is concerned with human endeavor. The student tests his capacities and proficiency, and conducts himself in the light of such self-knowledge. He attempts nothing beyond his powers, yet seeks to omit nothing within their scope. On the other hand, he sets himself aims that have to do with the ideals and the great duties of a human being. He does not mechanically regard himself as a wheel in the vast machinery of mankind, but seeks to comprehend the tasks of his life and to look out beyond the limit of the daily and trivial. He endeavors to fulfill his obligations ever better and more perfectly. The seventh deals with the effort to learn as much from life as possible. Nothing passes before the student without giving him occasion to accumulate experience which is of value to him for life. If he has performed anything wrongly or imperfectly, he lets this be an incentive for meeting the same contingency later on rightly and perfectly. When others act, he observes them with the same end in view. He tries to gather a rich store of experience, ever returning to it for counsel. Nor, indeed, will he ever do anything without looking back on experiences from which he can derive help in his decisions and affairs. Finally, the eighth is as follows. The student must, from time to time, glance introspectively into himself, sink back into himself, take counsel with himself, form and test the fundamental principles of his life, run over in his thoughts the sum total of his knowledge, weigh his duties, and reflect upon the content and aim of life. All these things have been mentioned in the preceding chapters, Here they are merely recapitulated in connection with the development of the 16-petaled lotus. By means of these exercises, the latter will become ever more and more perfect, for it is upon such exercises that the development of clairvoyance depends. The better the student's thoughts and speech harmonize with the processes in the outer world, the more quickly will he develop this faculty. Whoever thinks and speaks what is contrary to truth destroys something in the germ of his 16-petaled lotus. Truthfulness, uprightness, and honesty are in this connection creative forces, while mendacity, deceitfulness, and dishonesty are destructive forces. The student must realize, however, that actual deeds are needed and not merely good intentions. If I think or say something that does not conform with reality, I kill something in my spiritual organs, even though I believe my intentions to be ever so good. It is here as with the child, which needs must burn itself when it touches fire, even though it did so out of ignorance. The regulation of the above activities of the soul in the manner described causes the 16-petaled lotus to shine in glorious hues, and imparts to it a definite movement. Yet it must be noted that the faculty of clairvoyance cannot make its appearance before a definite degree of development of the soul has been reached. It cannot appear as long as it is irksome for the student to regulate his life in this manner. He is still unfit as long as the activities described above are a matter of special preoccupation for him. The first traces of clairvoyance only appear when he has reached the point of being able to live in the specified way, as a person habitually lives. These things must then no longer be laborious, but must have become a matter of course. There must be no need for him to be continually watching himself and urging himself on to live in this way. It must all have become a matter of habit. Now this lotus flower may be made to develop in another way by following certain other instructions. But all such methods are rejected by true spiritual science, for they lead to the destruction of physical health and to moral ruin. They are easier to follow than those here described. The latter, though protracted and difficult, lead to the true goal and cannot but strengthen morally. The distorted development of a lotus flower results not only in illusions and fantastic conceptions, should a certain degree of clairvoyance be acquired, but also in errors and instability in ordinary life. Such a development may be the cause of timidity, envy, vanity, haughtiness, willfulness, and so on in a person who hitherto was free from these defects. It has already been explained that 8 of the 16 petals of this lotus flower were developed in a remote past, and that these will reappear of themselves in the course of esoteric development. All the effort and attention of the student must be devoted to the remaining 8. Faulty training may easily result in the reappearance of the earlier petals alone, while the new petals remain stunted. This will ensue especially if too little logical, rational thinking is employed in the training. It is of supreme importance that the student should be a rational and clear-thinking person, and of further importance that he should practice the greatest clarity of speech. People who begin to have some presentiment of supersensible things are apt to wax talkative on this subject, thereby retarding their normal development. The less one talks about these matters, the better. Only someone who has achieved a certain degree of clarity should speak about them. At the beginning of their instruction, students are, as a rule, astonished at the teacher's lack of curiosity concerning their own experiences. It would be much better for them to remain entirely silent on this subject, and to content themselves with mentioning only whether they have been successful or unsuccessful in performing the exercises and observing the instructions given them. For the teacher has quite other means of estimating their progress than the student's own statements. The 8 petals now under consideration always become a little hardened through such statements, whereas they should be kept soft and supple. The following example, taken for the sake of clarity, not from the supersensible world but from ordinary life, will illustrate this point. Suppose I hear a piece of news, and thereupon immediately form an opinion. Shortly afterward I receive some further news which does not tally with the previous information. I am thereby obliged to reverse my previous judgment. The result is an unfavorable influence upon my 16-petaled lotus. Quite the contrary would have been the case had I, in the first place, suspended judgment and remained silent both inwardly in thought and outwardly in word concerning the whole affair, until I had acquired reliable grounds for forming my judgment. Caution in the formation and pronouncement of judgments becomes, by degrees, the special characteristic of the student. On the other hand, his receptivity for impressions and experiences increases. He lets them pass over him silently, so as to collect and have the largest possible number of facts at his disposal when the time comes to form his opinions. Bluish-red and reddish-pink shades of color, bluish-red and reddish-pink shades color the lotus flower as the result of such circumspection, whereas in the opposite case dark red and orange shades appear. Parenthesis, students will recognize in the conditions attached to the development of the 16-petaled lotus the instructions given by the Buddha to his disciples for the path. Yet there is no question here of teaching Buddhism, but of describing conditions governing development which are the natural outcome of spiritual science. The fact that these conditions correspond with certain teachings of the Buddha is no reason for not finding them true in themselves. Close parenthesis. The 12-petaled lotus, situated in the region of the heart, is developed in a similar way. Half its petals, too, were already existent and in active use in a remote stage of human evolution. Hence, these 6 petals need not now be especially developed in esoteric training. They appear of themselves and begin to revolve when the student sets to work on the other 6. Here again, he learns to promote this development by consciously controlling and directing certain inner activities in a special way. It must be clearly understood that the perceptions of each single organ of soul or spirit bear a different character. The 12 and 16-petaled lotus flowers transmit quite different perceptions. The latter perceives forms, the thoughts and mentality of other beings, and the laws governing natural phenomena become manifest through the 16-petaled lotus as figures, not rigid, motionless figures, but mobile forms filled with life. The clairvoyant in whom this sense is developed can describe for every mode of thought and for every law of nature a form which expresses them. A revengeful thought, for example, assumes an arrow-like, pronged form, while a kindly thought is often formed like an opening flower, and so on. Clear-cut, significant thoughts are regular and symmetrical in form, while confused thoughts have wavy outlines. Quite different perceptions are received through the 12-petaled lotus. These perceptions may, in a sense, be likened to warmth and cold, as applied to the soul. A clairvoyant equipped with this faculty feels this warmth and cold streaming out from the forms discerned by the 16-petaled lotus. Had he developed the 16 and not the 12-petaled lotus, he would only perceive, in the kindly thought, for instance, the figure described above. while a clairvoyant in whom both senses were developed would also notice what can only be described as soul warmth flowing from the thought. It should be noted in passing that esoteric training never develops one organ without the other, so that the above-mentioned example may be regarded as an hypothetical case in behalf of clarity. The 12-petal lotus, when developed, reveals to the clairvoyant a deep understanding of the processes of nature. Rays of soul warmth issue from every manifestation of growth and development, while everything in the process of decay, destruction, ruin, gives an impression of cold. The development of this sense may be furthered in the following manner. To begin with, the student endeavors to regulate his sequence of thought, control of thought. Just as the 16-petaled lotus is developed by cultivating thoughts that conform with truth and are significant, so too the 12-petaled lotus is developed by inwardly controlling the trains of thought, thoughts that dart to and fro like will-o'-the-wisps and follow each other in no logical or rational sequence, but merely by pure chance, destroy its form. The closer thought is made to follow upon thought, and the more strictly everything of illogical nature is avoided, the more suitable will be the form this sense organ develops. If the student hears illogical thoughts, he immediately lets the right thoughts pass through his mind. He should not, however, withdraw in a loveless way from what is perhaps an illogical environment in order to further his own development. Neither should he feel himself impelled to correct all the illogical thoughts expressed around him. He should, rather, silently coordinate the thoughts as they pour in upon him, and make them conform to logic and sense, and at the same time endeavor in every case to retain this same method in his own thinking. An equal consistency in his actions forms the second requirement, control of actions. All inconstancy, all disharmony of action, is baneful for the lotus flower here in question. When the student performs some action, he must see to it that his succeeding action follows in logical sequence. For if he acts from day to day with a variable intent, he will never develop the faculty here considered. The third requirement is the cultivation of endurance, perseverance. The student is impervious to all influences which would divert him from the goal he has set himself, as long as he can regard it as the right goal. For him, obstacles contain a challenge that impels him to surmount them, but never a reason for giving up. The fourth requirement is forbearance, tolerance toward persons, creatures, and also circumstances. The student suppresses all superfluous criticism of everything that is imperfect, evil, and bad, and seeks rather to understand everything that comes under his notice. Even as the sun does not withdraw its light from the bad and the evil, so he too does not refuse them an intelligent sympathy. Should some trouble befall him, he does not proceed to condemn and criticize, but accepts the inevitable and endeavors to the best of his ability to give the matter a turn for the best. He does not consider the opinions of others merely from his own standpoint, but seeks to put himself into the other's position. The fifth requirement is impartiality toward everything that life brings. In this connection, we speak of faith and trust. The student meets every human being and every creature with this trust, and lets it inspire his every action. Upon hearing some information, he never says to himself, quote, "I don't believe it. It contradicts my present opinions." Close quote. He is far rather ready to test and rectify his views and opinions. He ever remains receptive for everything that confronts him, and he trusts in the efficacy of his undertakings, timidity and skepticism are banished from his being. He harbors a faith in the power of his intentions. 100 failures cannot rob him of this faith. This is the faith which can move mountains. The 6th requirement is the cultivation of a certain inner balance, equanimity. The student endeavors to retain his composure in the face of joy and sorrow, and eradicates the tendency to fluctuate between the 7th heaven of joy and the depths of despair. Misfortune and danger, fortune and advancement alike, find him ready armed. The reader will recognize, in the qualities here described in the 6 attributes, which the candidate for initiation strives to acquire. The intention has been to show their connection with the spiritual organ known as the 12-petaled lotus flower. As before, special instructions can be given to bring this lotus flower to fruition, but here again the perfect symmetry of its form depends on the development of the qualities mentioned, the neglect of which results in this organ being formed into a caricature of its proper shape. In this case, should a certain clairvoyance be attained, the qualities in question may take an evil instead of a good direction. A person may become intolerant, timid, or contentious toward his environment, may, for instance, acquire some feeling for the sentiments of others, and for this reason shun them or hate them. This may even reach the point where, by reason of the inner coldness that overwhelms him, when he hears repugnant opinions, he is unable to listen, or he may behave in an objectionable manner. The development of this organ may be accelerated if, in addition to all that has been stated, certain other injunctions are observed which can only be imparted to the student by word of mouth. Yet the instructions given above do actually lead to genuine esoteric training, and, moreover, the regulation of life in the way described can be advantageous to all who cannot or will not undergo esoteric training. For it does not fail to produce an effect upon the organism of the soul, even though slowly. As regards the esoteric student, the observance of these principles is indispensable. Should he attempt esoteric training without conforming to them, this could only result in his entering the higher worlds with inadequate organs, and instead of perceiving the truth, he would be subject to deceptions and illusions. He would attain a certain clairvoyance, but for the most part be the victim of greater blindness than before. Formerly he at least stood firmly within the physical world. Now he looks beyond this physical world and grows confused about it before acquiring a firm footing in a higher world. All power of distinguishing truth from error would then perhaps fail him, and he would entirely lose his way in life. It is just for this reason that patience is so necessary in these matters. It must ever be borne in mind that the instructions given in esoteric training may go no further than is compatible with a willing readiness shown to develop the lotus flowers to their regular shape. Should these flowers be brought to fruition, before they have quietly attained their correct form, mere caricatures would be the result. Their maturity can be brought about by the special instructions given in esoteric training, but their form is dependent on the method of life described above. An inner training of a particularly intimate character is necessary for the development of the 10-petaled lotus flower, for it is now a question of learning consciously to control and dominate the sense impressions themselves. This is of particular importance in the initial stages of clairvoyance, for it is only by this means that a source of countless illusions and fancies is avoided. People, as a rule, do not realize by what factors their sudden ideas and memories are dominated, and how they are produced. Consider the following case. Someone is traveling by railway. His mind is busy with one thought. Suddenly, his thought diverges. He recollects an experience that befell him years ago and interweaves it with his present thought. He did not notice that in looking through the window he had caught sight of a person who resembled another intimately connected with the recollected experience. He remains conscious, not of what he saw, but of the effect it produced, and thus believes that it all came to him of its own accord. How much in life occurs in such a way? How great is the part played in our life by things we hear and learn, without our consciously realizing the connection? Someone, for instance, cannot bear a certain color, but does not realize that this is due to the fact that the schoolteacher who used to worry him many years ago wore a coat of that color. Innumerable illusions are based upon such associations. Many things leave their mark upon the soul, while remaining outside the pale of consciousness. The following may occur. Someone reads in the paper about the death of a well-known person, and forthwith claims to have had a presentiment of it yesterday, although he had neither heard nor seen anything that might have given rise to such a thought. And indeed it is quite true that the thought occurred to him yesterday, as though of its own accord, that this particular person would die. Only one thing escaped his attention. 2 or 3 hours before this thought occurred to him yesterday, he went to visit an acquaintance. A newspaper lay on the table. He did not actually read it, but his eyes, unconsciously, fell on the announcement of the dangerous illness of the person in question. He remained unconscious of the impression he had received, and yet this impression resulted in his presentiment. Reflection upon these matters will show how great is the source of illusion and fantasy contained in such associations. It is just this source which must be dammed up by all who seek to develop their 10-petaled lotus flower. Deeply hidden characteristics in other souls can be perceived by this organ, but their truth depends on the attainment of immunity from the above-mentioned illusions. For this purpose, it is necessary that the student should control and dominate everything that seeks to influence him from outside. He should reach the point of really receiving no impressions beyond those he wishes to receive. This can only be achieved by the development of a powerful inner life. By an effort of the will, he only allows such things to impress him to which his attention is directed, and he actually evades all impressions to which he does not voluntarily respond. If he sees something, it is because he wills to see it. And if he does not voluntarily take notice of something, it is actually non-existent for him. The greater the energy and inner activity devoted to this work, the more extensively will this faculty be attained. The student must avoid all vacuous gazing and mechanical listening. For him only those things exist to which he turns his eye or his ear. He must practice the power of hearing nothing, even in the greatest disturbance, if he does not will to hear. And he must make his eyes unimpressionable to things of which he does not particularly take notice. He must be shielded as by an inner armor against all unconscious impressions. In this connection, the student must devote special care to his thought life. He singles out a particular thought and endeavors to link with it only such other thoughts as he can himself consciously and voluntarily produce. He rejects all casual ideas and does not connect this thought with another until he has investigated the origin of the latter. He goes still further. If, for instance, he feels a particular antipathy for something, he will combat it and endeavor to establish a conscious relation between himself and the thing in question. In this way, the unconscious elements that intrude into his soul will become fewer and fewer. Only by such severe self-discipline can the 10-petaled lotus flower attain its proper form. A student's inner life must become a life of attention, and he must learn really to hold at a distance everything to which he should not or does not wish to direct his attention. If this strict self-discipline be accompanied by meditation as prescribed in esoteric training, the lotus flower in the region of the pit of the stomach comes to maturity in the right way, and light and color of a spiritual kind are now added to the form and warmth perceptible to the organs described above. The talents and faculties of other beings are thereby revealed, also the forces and the hidden attributes of nature. The colored aura of living creatures then becomes visible. All that is around us manifests its spiritual attributes. It must be understood that the very greatest care is necessary at this stage of development, for the play of unconscious memories is here exceedingly active. If this were not the case, many people would possess this inner sense, for it comes almost immediately into evidence when the impressions delivered by the outer senses are held so completely under control that they become dependent on nothing save attention or inattention. This inner sense remains ineffective as long as the powerful outer senses smother and benumb it. Still greater difficulty attends the development of the six-petaled lotus flower, situated in the center of the body, for it can only be achieved as the result of complete mastery and control of the whole personality through consciousness of self, so that body, soul, and spirit form one harmonious whole. The functions of the body, the inclinations and passions of the soul, the thoughts and ideas of the spirit must be tuned to perfect unison. The body must be so ennobled and purified that its organs incite to nothing that is not in the service of the soul and spirit. The soul must not be impelled through the body to lusts and passions which are antagonistic to pure and noble thought. Yet the spirit must not stand like a slave driver over the soul, dominating it with laws and commandments. The soul must rather learn to obey these laws and duties out of its own free inclination. The student must not feel duty to be an oppressive power to which he unwillingly submits, but rather something which he performs out of love. His task is to develop a free soul that maintains equilibrium between body and spirit, and he must perfect himself in this way to the extent of being free to abandon himself to the functions of the senses, that these should be so purified that they lose the power to drag him down to their level. He must no longer require to curb his passions, inasmuch as they, of their own accord, follow the good. So long as self-chastisement is necessary, no one can pass a certain stage of esoteric development. For a virtue practiced under constraint is futile. If there is any lust remaining, it interferes with esoteric development, however great the effort made not to humor it. Nor does it matter whether this desire proceeds from the soul or the body. For example, if a certain stimulant be avoided for the purpose of self-purification, this deprivation will only prove helpful if the body suffers no harm from it. Should the contrary be the case, this proves that the body craves the stimulant and that abstinence from it is of no value. In this case, it may actually be a question of renouncing the ideal to be attained until more favorable physical conditions, perhaps in another life, shall be forthcoming. A wise renunciation may be a far greater achievement than the struggle for something which, under given conditions, remains unattainable. Indeed, a renunciation of this kind contributes more toward development than the opposite course. The six-petaled lotus flower, when developed, permits of intercourse with beings of higher worlds, though only when their existence is manifested in the astral or soul world. The development of this lotus flower, however, is not advisable unless the student has made great progress on that path of esoteric development which enables him to raise his spirit into a still higher world. This entry into the spiritual world proper must always run parallel with the development of the lotus flowers. Otherwise, the student will fall into error and confusion. He would undoubtedly be able to see, but he would remain incapable of forming a correct estimate of what he saw. Now, the development of the six-petaled lotus flower itself provides a certain security against confusion and instability, for no one can be easily confused who has attained perfect equilibrium between sense or body, passion or soul, and idea or spirit. And yet something more than this security is required when, through the development of the six-petaled lotus flower, living beings of independent existence are revealed to his spirit, beings belonging to a world so completely different from the world known to his physical senses. The development of the lotus flowers alone does not assure sufficient security in these higher worlds. Still higher organs are necessary. The latter will now be described before the remaining lotus flowers and the further organization of the soul body are discussed. This expression, soul-body, although obviously contradictory when taken literally, is used because, to clairvoyant perception, the impression received spiritually corresponds to the impression received physically when the physical body is perceived. The development of the soul-body, in the manner described above, permits of perception in a supersensible world. But anyone wishing to find his way in this world must not remain stationary at this stage of development. The mere mobility of the lotus flowers is not sufficient. The student must acquire the power of regulating and controlling the movement of his spiritual organs independently and with complete consciousness. Otherwise, he would become a plaything for external forces and powers. To avoid this, he must acquire the faculty of hearing what is called the inner word. And this involves the development not only of the soul body, but also of the etheric body. The latter is that tenuous body revealed to the clairvoyant as a kind of double of the physical body, and forms to a certain extent an intermediate step between the soul nature and the physical body. See the description in the author's book titled Theosophy. It is possible for one equipped with clairvoyant powers consciously to suggest away the physical body of a person. This corresponds, on a higher plane, to an exercise in attentiveness on a lower plane. Just as a person can divert his attention from something in front of him so that it becomes non-existent for him, the clairvoyant can extinguish a physical body from his field of observation so that it becomes physically transparent to him. If he exerts this faculty in the case of some person standing before him, there remains visible to his clairvoyant sight only the etheric body, besides the soul body, which is larger than the other two, etheric and physical bodies, and interpenetrates them both. The etheric body has approximately the size and form of the physical body, so that it practically fills the same space. It is an extremely delicate and finely organized structure. parenthesis, I beg the physicist not to be disturbed at the expression etheric body. The word ether here is merely used to suggest the fineness of the body in question, and need not in any way be connected with the hypothetical ether of physics. Close parenthesis. Its ground color is different from any of the seven colors contained in the rainbow. Anyone capable of observing it will find a color which is actually non-existent for sense perception, but to which the color of young peach blossom may be comparable. If desired, the etheric body can be examined alone. For this purpose, the soul body must be extinguished by an effort of attentiveness in the manner described above. Otherwise, the etheric body will present an ever-changing picture, owing to its interpenetration by the soul body. Now, the particles of the etheric body are in continual motion. Countless currents stream through it in every direction. By these currents, life itself is maintained and regulated. Every body that has life, including animals and plants, possesses an etheric body. Even in minerals, traces of it can be observed. These currents and movements are, to begin with, independent of human will and consciousness, just as the action of the heart or stomach is beyond our jurisdiction. And this independence remains unaltered as long as we do not take our development in hand in the sense of acquiring supersensible faculties. For at a certain stage, development consists precisely in adding to the unconscious currents and movements of the etheric body others that are consciously produced and controlled. When esoteric development has progressed so far that the lotus flowers begin to stir, much has already been achieved by the student, which can result in the formation of certain quite definite currents and movements in his etheric body. The object of this development is the formation of a kind of center in the region of the physical heart, from which radiate currents and movements in the greatest possible variety of colors and forms. The center is, in reality, not a mere point, but a most complicated structure, a most wonderful organ. It glows and shimmers with every shade of color and displays forms of great symmetry, capable of rapid transformation. Other forms and streams of color radiate from this organ to the other parts of the body, and beyond it to the astral body, completely permeating and illuminating it. The most important of these currents flow to the lotus flowers. They permeate each petal and regulate its revolutions. Then, streaming out at the points of the petals, they lose themselves in outer space. The higher the development of a person, the greater the circumference of which these rays extend. The 12-petaled lotus flower has a particular close connection with this central organ. The currents flow directly into it and through it, proceeding on the one side to the 16 and the 2-petaled lotus flowers, and on the other the lower side to the flowers of 8, 6, and 4 petals. It is for this reason that the very greatest care must be devoted to the development of the 12-petaled lotus, for an imperfection in the latter would result in the irregular formation of the whole structure. The above will give an idea of the delicate and intimate nature of esoteric training, and of the accuracy needed if the development is to be regular and correct. It will also be evident, beyond doubt, that directions for the development of supersensible faculties can only be the concern of those who have themselves experienced everything which they propose to awaken in others, and who are unquestionably in a position to know whether the directions they give lead to the exact results desired. If the student follows the directions that have been given him, he introduces into his etheric body currents and movements which are in harmony with the laws and the evolution of the world to which he belongs. Consequently, these instructions are reflections of the great laws of cosmic evolution. They consist of the above-mentioned and similar exercises in meditation and concentration, which, if correctly practiced, produce the results described. The student must at certain times let these instructions permeate his soul with their content, so that he is inwardly entirely filled with it. A simple start is made with a view to the deepening of the logical activity of the mind and the producing of an inward intensification of thought. Thought is thereby made free and independent of all sense impressions and experiences. It is concentrated in one point, which is held entirely under control. Thus a preliminary center is formed for the currents of the etheric body. This center is not yet in the region of the heart, but in the head, and it appears to the clairvoyant as the point of departure for movements and currents. No esoteric training can be successful which does not first create this center. If the latter were first formed in the region of the heart, the aspiring clairvoyant would doubtless obtain glimpses of the higher worlds, but would lack all true insight into the connection between these higher worlds and the world of our senses. This, however, is an unconditional necessity for man at the present stage of evolution. The clairvoyant must not become a visionary. He must retain a firm footing upon the earth. The center in the head, once duly fixed, is then moved lower down to the region of the larynx. This is effected by further exercises in concentration. Then the currents of the etheric body radiate from this point and illumine the astral space surrounding the individual. Continued practice enables the student to determine for himself the position of his etheric body. Hitherto this position depended upon external forces proceeding from the physical body. Through further development, the student is able to turn his etheric body to all sides. This faculty is effected by currents moving approximately along both hands and centered in the two-petaled lotus in the region of the eyes. All this is made possible through the radiations from the larynx assuming round forms, of which a number flow to the two-petaled lotus and thence form undulating currents along the hands. As a further development, these currents branch out and ramify in the most delicate manner, and become, as it were, a kind of web, which then encompasses the entire etheric body as though with a network. Whereas hitherto the etheric body was not closed to the outer world, so that the life currents from the universal ocean of life flowed freely in and out, these currents now have to pass through this membrane. Thus the individual becomes sensitive to these external streams. They become perceptible to him. And now the time has come to give the complete system of currents and movements its center, situated in the region of the heart. This again is effected by persevering with the exercises in concentration and meditation. And at this point also, the stage is reached when the student becomes gifted with the inner word. All things now acquire a new significance for him. They become, as it were, spiritually audible in their innermost self, and speak to him of their essential being. The currents described above place him in touch with the inner being of the world to which he belongs. He begins to mingle his life with the life of his environment and can let it reverberate in the movements of his lotus flowers. At this point, the spiritual world is entered. if the student has advanced so far, he acquires a new understanding for all that the great teachers of humanity have uttered. The sayings of the Buddha and the Gospels, for instance, produce a new effect on him. They pervade him with a rapture of which he had not dreamt before. For the tone of their words follows the movements and rhythms which he has himself formed within himself. He can now have positive knowledge that a Buddha or the evangelists did not utter their own revelations, but those which flowed into them from the inmost being of all things. A fact must here be pointed out which can only be understood in the light of what has been said above. The many repetitions in the sayings of the Buddha are not comprehensible to people of our present evolutionary stage. For the esoteric student, however, they become a force on which he gladly lets his inner senses rest, for they correspond with certain movements in the etheric body. Devotional surrender to them with perfect inner peace creates an inner harmony with these movements, and because the latter are an image of certain cosmic rhythms, which also at certain points repeat themselves and revert to former modes, the student listening to the wisdom of the Buddha unites his life with that of the cosmic mysteries. In esoteric training, there is question of four attributes which must be acquired on the so-called preparatory path for the attainment of higher knowledge. The first is the faculty of discriminating in thoughts between truth and appearance, or mere opinion. The second attribute is the correct estimation of what is inwardly true and real, as against what is merely apparent. The third rests in the practice of the six qualities already mentioned in the preceding pages: thought control, control of actions, perseverance, tolerance, faith, and equanimity. The fourth attribute is the love of inner freedom. A mere intellectual understanding of what is included in these attributes is of no value. They must be so incorporated into the soul that they form the basis of inner habits. Consider, for instance, the first of these attributes, the discrimination between truth and appearance. The student must so train himself that, as a matter of course, he distinguishes in everything that confronts him between the non-essential elements and those that are significant and essential. He will only succeed in this if, in his observation of the outer world, he quietly and patiently ever and again repeats the attempt. And at the end, he will naturally single out the essential and the true at a glance, whereas formerly the non-essential, the transient, too, could content him. All that is transient is but a seeming, is a truth which becomes an unquestionable conviction of the soul. The same applies to the remaining three of the four attributes mentioned. Now these four inner habits do actually produce a transformation of the delicate human etheric body. By the first, discrimination between truth and appearance, the center in the head, already described, is formed, and the center in the region of the larynx prepared. The actual development of these centers is, of course, dependent on the exercises in concentration described above. The latter make for development, and the four attributes bring to fruition. Once the center in the larynx has been prepared, the free control of the etheric body and its enclosure within a network covering, as explained above, results from the correct estimation of what is true, as against what is apparent and non-essential. If the student acquires this faculty of estimation, the facts of the higher worlds will gradually become perceptible to him. But he must not think that he has to perform only such actions which appear significant when judged by the standard of a mere intellectual estimate. The most trifling action, every little thing accomplished, has something of importance in the great cosmic household, and it is merely a question of being aware of this importance. A correct estimation of the affairs of daily life is required, not an underestimation of them. The six virtues of which the third attribute consists have already been dealt with. They are connected with the development of the 12-petaled lotus in the region of the heart, and, as already indicated, it is to this center that the life currents of the etheric body must be directed. The fourth attribute, the longing for liberation, serves to bring to fruition the etheric organ in the heart region. Once this attribute becomes an inner habit, the individual frees himself from everything which depends only upon the faculties of his own personal nature. He ceases to view things from his own separate standpoint, and the boundaries of his own narrow self, fettering him to this point of view, disappear. The secrets of the spiritual world gain access to his inner self. This is liberation. For those fetters constrain the individual to regard things and beings in a manner corresponding to his own personal traits. It is from this personal manner of regarding things that the student must become liberated and free. It will be clear from the above that the instructions given in esoteric training exert a determining influence reaching the innermost depths of human nature. Such are the instructions regarding the four qualities mentioned above. They can be found in one form or another in all the great cosmogonies that take account of the spiritual world. The founders of the great cosmogonies did not give mankind these teachings from some vague feeling. They gave them for the good reason that they were great initiates. Out of their knowledge did they shape their moral teachings. They knew how these would act upon the finer nature of man, and desired that their followers should gradually achieve the development of this finer nature. To live in the sense of these great cosmogonies means to work for the attainment of personal spiritual perfection. Only by so doing can man become a servant of the world and of humanity. Self-perfection is by no means self-seeking, for the imperfect man is an imperfect servant of the world and of humanity. The more perfect a man is, the better does he serve the world. If the rose adorns itself, it adorns the garden. The founders of the great cosmogonies are therefore the great initiates. Their teaching flows into the soul of men, and thus with humanity the whole world moves forward. Quite consciously did they work to further this evolutionary process of humanity. Their teachings can only be understood if it be remembered that they are the product of knowledge of the innermost depths of human nature. The great initiates knew, and it is out of their knowledge, that they shaped the ideals of humanity. And man approaches these great leaders when he uplifts himself in his own development to their heights. A completely new life opens out before the student when the development of his etheric body begins in the way described above, and at the proper time in the course of his training. A completely new life opens out before the student when the development of his etheric body begins in the way described above, and at the proper time, in the course of his training, he must receive that enlightenment which enables him to adapt himself to this new existence. The 16-petaled lotus, for instance, enables him to perceive spiritual figures of a higher world. He must learn now how different these figures can be when caused by different objects or beings. In the first place, he must notice that his own thoughts and feelings exert a powerful influence on certain of these figures, on others little or no influence. One kind of figure alters immediately if the observer, upon seeing it, says to himself, "That is beautiful," and then, in the course of his observation, changes this thought to, "That is useful." It is characteristic of the forms proceeding from minerals or from artificial objects that they change under the influence of every thought and every feeling directed upon them by the observer. This applies in a lesser degree to the forms belonging to plants, and still less to those corresponding to animals. These figures, too, are full of life and motion, but this motion is only partially due to the influence of human thoughts and feelings. In other respects, it is produced by causes which are beyond human influence. Now, there appears within this whole world a species of form which remains almost entirely unaffected by human influence. The student can convince himself that these forms proceed neither from minerals nor from artificial objects, nor again from plants or animals. To gain complete understanding, he must study those forms which he can realize to have proceeded from the feelings, instincts, and passions of human beings. Yet he can find that these forms, too, are influenced by his own thoughts and feelings, if only to a relatively small extent. But there always remains a residuum of forms in this world upon which such influences are negligible. Indeed, at the outset of his career, the student can perceive little beyond this residuum. He can only discover its nature by observing himself. He then learns what forms he himself produces, for his will, his wishes, and so on, are expressed in these forms. An instinct that dwells in him, a desire that fills him, an intention that he harbors, and so forth, are all manifested in these forms. His whole character displays itself in this world of forms. Thus, by his conscious thoughts and feelings, a person can exercise an influence on all forms which do not proceed from himself, but over those which he brings about in the higher world, through his own being, he possesses no power once he has created them. Now it follows from what has been said that on this higher plane, man's inner life of instincts, desires, ideas displays itself outwardly in definite forms, just like all other beings and objects. To higher knowledge, the inner world appears as part of the outer world. In a higher world, man's inner being confronts him as a reflected image, just as though in the physical world he were surrounded by mirrors and could observe his physical body in that way. At this stage of development, the student has reached the point where he can free himself from the illusion resulting from the limitation of his personal self. He can now observe that inner self as outer world. Just as he hitherto regarded as outer world everything that affected his senses, thus he learns by gradual experience to deal with himself as hitherto he dealt with the beings around him. Were the student to obtain an insight into these spiritual worlds without sufficient preparation regarding their nature, he would find himself confronted by the picture of his own soul, as though by an enigma. There his own desires and passions confront him in animal, or more rarely in human forms. It is true that the animal forms of this world are never quite similar to those of the physical world, yet they possess a remote resemblance. inexpert observers often take them to be identical. Now, upon entering this world, an entirely new method of judgment must be acquired. For apart from the fact that things actually pertaining to inner nature appear as outer world, they also bear the character of mirrored reflections of what they really are. When, for instance, a number is perceived, it must be read in reverse, as a picture in a mirror. 2, 6, 5 would mean here, in reality, 5, 6, 2. A sphere is perceived as though from its center. This inner perception must be translated in the right way. The qualities of the soul appear likewise as in a mirror. A wish directed toward an outer object appears as a form moving toward the person wishing. Passions residing in the lower part of human nature can assume animal forms or similar shapes that hurl themselves against the individual. In reality, these passions are headed outward. They seek satisfaction in the outer world, but this striving outward appears in the mirrored reflection as an attack on the individual from whom they proceed. If the student, before attaining insight into higher worlds, has learned by quiet and sincere self-observation to realize the qualities and defects of his own character, he will then, at the moment when his own inner self confronts him as a mirrored image, find strength and courage to conduct himself in the right way. People who have failed to test themselves in this way and are insufficiently acquainted with their own inner self will not recognize themselves in their own mirrored image and will mistake it for an alien reality. Or they may become alarmed at the vision and, because they cannot endure the sight, deceive themselves into believing the whole thing is nothing but an illusion, which cannot lead them anywhere. In either case, the person in question, through prematurely attaining a certain stage of inner development, would fatally obstruct his own progress. It is absolutely necessary that the student should experience this spiritual aspect of his own inner self before progressing to higher spheres. For his own self constitutes that psycho-spiritual element of which he is the best judge. If he has thoroughly realized the nature of his own personality in the physical world, and if the image of his personality first appears to him in a higher world, he is then able to compare the one with the other. He can refer the higher to something already known to him, so that his point of departure is on firm ground. Whereas, no matter how many other spiritual beings appeared to him, he would find himself unable to discover their nature and qualities, and would soon feel the ground giving way beneath him. Thus it cannot be too often repeated that the only safe entrance into the higher worlds is at the end of a path leading through a genuine knowledge and estimate of one's own nature. Pictures, then, of a spiritual kind are first encountered by the student on his progress into the higher worlds. And the reality to which these pictures correspond is actually within himself. He should be far enough advanced to refrain from desiring reality of a more robust kind at this initial stage, and to regard these pictures as timely. He will soon meet something quite new within this world of pictures. His lower self is before him as a mirrored image, but from within this image there appears the true reality of his higher self. Out of the picture of his lower personality, the form of the spiritual ego becomes visible. Then threads are spun from the latter to the other and higher spiritual realities. This is the moment when the two-petaled lotus in the region of the eyes is required. If it now begins to stir, the student finds it possible to bring his higher ego in contact with higher spiritual beings. The currents from this lotus flower flow toward the higher realities in such a way that the movements in question are fully apparent to the individual. Just as the light renders the physical objects visible, so too these currents disclose spiritual beings of higher worlds. Through inward application to the fundamental truths derived from spiritual science, the student learns to set in motion and then to direct the currents proceeding from the lotus flower between the eyes. It is at this stage of development, especially, that the value of sound judgment and a training in clear and logical thought come to the fore. The higher self, which hitherto slumbered unconsciously in an embryonic state, is now born into conscious existence. This is not a figurative, but a positive birth in the spiritual world. And the being now born, the higher self, must enter that world with all the necessary organs and aptitudes if it is to be capable of life. Just as nature must provide for a child being born into the world with suitable eyes and ears, so too the laws of self-development must provide for the necessary capacities with which the higher self can enter existence. These laws, governing the development of the higher spiritual organs, are none other than the laws of sound reason and morality of the physical world. The spiritual self matures in the physical self as a child in the mother's womb. The child's health depends upon the normal functioning of natural laws in the maternal womb. The constitution of the spiritual self is similarly conditioned by the laws of common intelligence and reason that govern physical life. No one can give birth to a soundly constituted higher self whose life in thought and feeling in the physical world is not sound and healthy. Natural, rational life is the basis of all genuine spiritual development. Just as the child, when still in the maternal womb, lives in accordance with the natural forces to which it has access after its birth through its organs of sense, so too the human higher self lives in accordance with the laws of the spiritual world even during physical existence. And even as the child, out of a dim life instinct, acquires the requisite forces, so too can man acquire the powers of the spiritual world before his higher self is born. Indeed, he must do this if the latter is to enter the world as a fully developed being. It would be quite wrong for anyone to say, "I cannot accept the teachings of spiritual science until I myself become a seer." For without inward application to the results of spiritual research, there is no chance whatever of attaining genuine higher knowledge. It would be as though a child, during gestation, were to refuse the forces coming to it through its mother, and proposed to wait until it could procure them for itself. Just as the embryonic child, in its incipient feeling for life, learns to appreciate what is offered to it, so can the non-seer appreciate the truth of the teachings of spiritual science. An insight into these teachings, based on a deeply rooted feeling for truth and a clear, sound, all-round critical and reasoning faculty, are possible even before spiritual things are actually perceived. The esoteric knowledge must first be studied so that this study becomes a preparation for clairvoyance. A person attaining clairvoyance without such preparation would resemble a child born with eyes and ears but without a brain. The entire world of sound and color would display itself before him, but he would be helpless in it. At this stage of his esoteric development, the student realizes, through personal inward experience, all that had previously appealed to his sense of truth, to his intellect and reason. He has now direct knowledge of his higher self. He learns how his higher self is connected with exalted spiritual beings and forms with them a united whole. He sees how the lower self originates in a higher world, and it is revealed to him how his higher nature outlasts his lower. He can now distinguish the imperishable in himself from the perishable. That is, he learns through personal insight to understand the doctrine of the incarnation of the higher self in the lower. It will become plain to him that he is part of a great spiritual complex, and that his qualities and destiny are due to this connection. He learns to recognize the law of his life, his karma. He realizes that his lower self, constituting his present existence, is only one of the forms which his higher being can adopt. He discerns the possibility of working down from his higher self in his lower self, so that he may perfect himself ever more and more. Now, too, he can comprehend the great differences between human beings in regard to their level of perfection. He becomes aware that there are others above him who have already traversed the stages which still lie before him, and he realizes that the teachings and deeds of such men proceed from the inspiration of a higher world. He owes this knowledge to his first personal glimpse into this higher world. The so-called initiates of humanity now become vested with reality for him. These, then, are the gifts which the student owes to his development at this stage: insight into his higher self, insight into the doctrine of the incarnation of this higher being in a lower, insight into the laws by which life in the physical world is regulated according to its spiritual connections, that is, the law of karma, and finally insight into the existence of the great initiates. Thus it is said of a student who has reached this stage that all doubt has vanished from him. His former faith, based on reason and sound thought, is now replaced by knowledge and insight which nothing can undermine. The various religions have presented in their ceremonies, sacraments, and rites externally visible pictures of the higher spiritual beings and events. None but those who have not penetrated to the depths of the great religions can fail to recognize this fact. Personal insight into spiritual reality explains the great significance of these externally visible cults. Religious service, then, becomes for the seer an image of his own communion with the higher spiritual world. It has been shown how the student, by attaining this stage, becomes in truth a new being. He can now mature to still higher faculties, and by means of the life currents of his etheric body, control the higher and actual life element, thus attaining a high degree of independence from the restrictions of the physical body. The end of chapter 6.